Last week, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Cox versus Sony, a case with huge ramifications for the future of the internet. The question at the heart of the case is, who is responsible for copyright infringement online? In this case, a group of copyright holders sued not individual infringers, but an internet service provider. That ISP did not encourage or facilitate infringement. Rather, it simply didn't do enough, in the rights holder's view, to terminate the accounts used by the actual wrongdoers. Many of those accounts belong to entire businesses, universities, or hospitals, meaning that termination would end service for thousands of innocent users. But no matter. A jury awarded the rights holders a billion-dollar verdict against the ISP. This is the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm a slightly under the weather Corbin Barthold, so I apologize for my voice quality. It is my great privilege to be joined today by Pam Samuelson. She is the Richard M. Sherman Distinguished Professor of Law and Information at the University of California, Berkeley. She is a director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. Above all, she is one of the foremost tech and copyright law experts in the known universe. Professor Samuelson, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So excited to have you here. We don't do much copyright law on the podcast, so I think we should start with a primer. How does copyright law work in the context of the internet?
So copyright law gives authors exclusive rights to control the reproduction and distribution of copies of their works, whether it's on the internet or otherwise. And so if you reproduce a copyrighted work, such as recorded music, and you distribute those copies to other people, that's infringement of copyright. Now, the law doesn't have a contributory infringement standard the way that trademark law and patent law has one, but courts have used general principles of tort law to say that if you have contributed to someone else's infringement intentionally, that can be the basis of holding someone liable. And so the theory on which Sony Music is proceeding in this case is a contributory infringement claim on the idea that Cox knew that certain of its subscribers had users who infringed, and they kept providing service to those customers and thereby contributed to infringement, knowing that they were making that kind of contribution.
And I can think of a couple times we have touched more or less in passing on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act on the show. That seems like a key piece here. How does that play in?
Well, directly, not at all, because the case really calls for an interpretation of the scope of secondary liability for infringement based on common law standards. And so the Digital Millennium Copyright Act isn't directly involved in the case, and yet both Cox and Sony are making arguments that rely in part on the DMCA. Now, the DMCA has safe harbor provisions, and those safe harbor provisions, whether you're a conduit or whether you are a service provider of other kinds, such as a host of content, those are based on whether they are conditioned on whether or not you have and enforce a repeat infringer policy. And so one of the things that happened in the lower courts was that the courts decided that Cox did not qualify for the safe harbor because it didn't enforce its repeat infringer policy stringently enough to satisfy the law. So that's one way in which the DMCA has some implications for the case. But the DMCA also has a provision that says that even if you don't qualify for the safe harbor, that doesn't automatically mean that you are a contributory infringer. It means that it's not supposed to have any bearing on the liability standard. And so from Cox's standpoint, 512L, which is the part of the safe harbor provision that says that you shouldn't make adverse inferences if they don't qualify for the repeat infringer policy limitation. And you have the argument on Sony's side that the safe harbor was also intended to give internet service providers incentive to participate with copyright owners in reducing infringement. And because Cox is not doing that, and if you let Cox win on this particular case, they will have zero incentive to cooperate with copyright owners. And so that's actually a place where there's, even though it's not directly involved in the case, there are arguments about the DMCA that both Cox and Sony are relying on.
It is helpful and illuminating to me as a non-copyright expert to hear you say that it is only indirectly relevant, because it kept coming up in the briefs and at oral argument. And I was getting a bit turned around about how it plays in. And then at some point, I think both in the briefs and in the oral argument, the point was made, well, the secondary liability in the copyright scheme is drawn from the common law. So nothing is to stop people from sending Cox notices about any kind of illegality that could potentially create secondary liability if we go down this road. And I went, wait, what? So this is not a special copyright thing. If people start sending notices about any kind of illegal contents on the internet, we could be terminating internet accounts. So very, very helpful to me. As I said, we are dealing, and as you said, we are dealing with contributory liability, and the discussion centered around that. And Justice Kagan at one point, I thought, summarized things well. She said that there are three principles that she drew from the case law. And one is that a defendant must seek to bring the wrong about. And two, that there must be some kind of misfeasance to be distinguished from mere nonfeasance. And three, that the defendant didn't just treat the customer in question like everyone else, did something special for them. Do you think that is an accurate summary? And if it is, it kind of sounds like this is an easy case.
So I think that Justice Kagan was pretty clear that from her standpoint, Sony didn't meet any of those principles, didn't satisfy those principles. So there was no evidence that Cox wanted people to infringe. There was nonfeasance rather than mal or misfeasance. And Cox wasn't doing anything to help anybody infringe, so that it was treating them like everybody else. So I think it is the case that those principles, if adopted by all of the justices, would result in the court granting Cox's motion for judgment as a matter of law. And so that would mean not only would the $1 billion damage award go away, but it would mean that that Sony could not go back and try the case again. And I think those were the principles she distilled from the case law. But I'm not sure all of the justices would go in the same direction. So especially Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson, I think both were more sympathetic to Sony and were worried about what would happen if they just granted that judgment as a matter of law. You know, would Cox have any incentive at all to cooperate with copyright owners and terminate anybody based on this? And so I think part of the question in that case is really whether copyright should have its own special contributory infringement rule, or whether it should have a rule that's consistent with common law, aiding and abetting law, or third possibility is that the copyright law would be interpreted the same as patent law, which has a codified contributory infringement standard, which, frankly, Sony would not be able to meet. So there are, I think, a couple of different options here. I see the case as easy in terms of sort of reversal. I don't see any of the justices actually thinking that the standard that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals endorsed, simply, you know, you contributed by not cutting off enough people, and you knew that they were substantially likely to have some infringements in the future, and therefore you're a contributory infringer. I don't see any of the justices as buying that particular interpretation, but it's not clear where they're going to go.
Yes, Justice Sotomayor said emphatically at one point to Cox, "You did nothing." And Justice Barrett said, "What incentives would you have to do anything if you won?" Definitely some concern there. Justice Sotomayor at one point said, "We're being put to two extremes." And at points, Cox was willing to embrace that framing of the case. I think it might have been Justice Kagan who said, "So it's irrelevant to the case whether Cox was a good corporate citizen." And Josh Rosenkranz said he contested the premise, but said, "Yes, as a matter of law, it's irrelevant to the case." And weirdly, we can't escape the DMCA. It seems to me, because without the DMCA, it makes sense from my perspective. You don't want to go deep into the stack and start holding. Justice Barrett brought up the electrical company. Well, why can't we shut off the electricity to a house that's doing bad things? And what's the distinction between the electrical company and an ISP? And the attorney for the United States said, "Well, the DMCA. The existence of the DMCA shows that Congress had some kind of different conception for an internet service provider. So it does potentially, Congress, think that an ISP should be responsible for copyright infringement of its users." What do you think of that?
One of the things that was frustrating to me was that none of the litigants and none of the justices really noticed that the safe harbor provision of the DMCA applies to three categories of internet service providers. So if you're a host and you get a notice about somebody infringing, you have a responsibility to go investigate and take it down if the infringement claim is sound. There's also a provision there for caching, right? If you cache something and the cache has illegal content or copyright infringing content, you get notice, you have a responsibility to take it down. And if you're an information location tool, such as a search engine, and you're linking to some place that has infringing material and you get notice about that, you have a responsibility to go and do something about it and take it down, okay? Now, there's a fourth provision there for conduits. And if you look at what kind of service that Cox provides, it's really a conduit. And the conduit does not have a notice and takedown provision that's similar to the one for the other three types of internet service providers. And so you could read the DMCA to say you don't have any responsibility at all under the statute to take something down. So what Sony has been trying to do through these lawsuits against Cox and a few others of the broadband providers is to try to, in some sense, put indirectly a notice and takedown regime for the conduits. The problem is that it's not possible for Cox to actually take anything down because it doesn't have any infringing content. Right? In contrast to the other three categories, they can actually investigate and take something down. And Cox basically doesn't have that kind of control. So to me, the fact that there's no notice and takedown requirement in the statute should be a strong support for Cox's position. And it just didn't come up, and I don't know why.
Very interesting. That also gives me thoughts about the way that Twitter versus Tomna was discussed in the case. We recently had that Supreme Court decision involving whether Twitter could be liable for aiding and abetting ISIS because there were ISIS accounts on Twitter and Twitter didn't take them down. And a lot of the language about aiding and abetting that everybody's discussing, the three principles Kagan brought up, for instance, come from that case as well as a few others. And there was attention paid to whether Cox did more than Twitter, or is more culpable, because did it have notice of specific wrongful acts here, whereas Twitter only had notice that there were potentially bad accounts or bad material? I've never thought Thomas's description of the facts in that case was quite accurate. At any rate, it sounds like maybe they should have been going the other way and talking about how this case is different because of the distinction between the two entities in the stack. And no one seemed to really pay attention to that or understand it. There was some talk by some of the justices that made it sound like a social media platform and an ISP are completely equivalent.
So I think the Supreme Court isn't exactly the most internet savvy group of people in the country. And so, you know, they're trying to do their best, I think, to make sensible interpretations of the law as applied to the internet. And I think the Solicitor General was really the most influential of the participants in the oral argument in terms of sort of thinking about the implications of the Twitter versus Tomna case, and really saying you got to provide substantial assistance, and you actually have to, there has to be some causal connection here, and you have to be able to like do something, right? And so what is Cox doing? It's providing a communication service the way that Twitter was providing a communication service, and it's providing it without providing any kind of special assistance to infringers any more than Twitter was providing substantial assistance to the terrorists. So, you know, I think it's really telling that Solicitor General, which usually has a pretty carefully carved out position, for the Solicitor General to come in and basically say, no, general principles of tort law should apply here. The Twitter case was about aiding and abetting, and basically articulated that there has to be purposeful, culpable conduct that is the basis of the secondary liability. And the Solicitor General just didn't see that there was the kind of purposeful, culpable conduct that was required for holding secondary liability. And I think it's telling that there was nobody from the Copyright Office on the Solicitor General's brief. And in most of the court's copyright cases in the last decade or two, Copyright Office personnel were on the briefs. And so I'm pretty sure that the Solicitor General ended up taking a stance that the Copyright Office did not support.
Sticking with the theme of Supreme Court arguments not bringing together the greatest experts on the internet, a lot of very good lawyers arguing this, Josh Rosenkranz for Cox and Paul Clement for Sony, and I believe it was Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart for the United States. It was left to Justice Alito to carry the flag of internet access. He said, quote, "I don't see how Sony's position is workable at all." He said that to Paul Clement, counsel for Sony. And I was struck that in the course of his response, Paul Clement is challenged by Justice Alito. Okay, lots of people may be on a single account for an ISP, so you're at risk of shutting down internet for the entire university or hospital or regional ISP, whatever. And Paul Clement said, well, a university could cut down all the students' bandwidth so that they didn't have fast enough internet to engage in large amounts of copyright infringement. And I found that kind of flabbergasting. These are all very talented attorneys in terms of standing up and arguing at the Supreme Court, but that seemed to betray a real ignorance of how the internet works and what people are using the internet for. I assume there are researchers at universities who need fast internet connections, for example. And so it was a bit disappointing to see the details of an actually pretty technical field lost in the shuffle of aiding and abetting principles that are being applied to, we're making analogies with sales of guns or whatever.
It was the case that Clement was pretty fast on his feet. And so he had to have some sort of response to the, what do you do about the university problem? And I think the kind of like, from what I could tell, if there was a way to distinguish the kind of institutional versus residential accounts that Sotomayor would sort of say, yeah, the, you know, the hospital or the military barracks or the university, you can't cut off internet access for everybody when only a small number of people are using it in an abusive way. They would all be happy, I think, to say, you know, that there's no liability when, you know, you don't have any control over what the people are doing, and you're just providing a general service to accounts. But I think the sense I got was that at least Justice Sotomayor would say, you know, with residents, you know, yeah, cutting it off for the family would be harmful to some of the members of the family. But you could actually then, you know, make sure that Junior is no longer using it for BitTorrent purposes. Punish him, and then the family can get back on. So I won't be entirely surprised if there's sort of some effort, even if only in a concurring opinion, to say the institutional issues should be dealt with differently than the residential issues. So I don't know that that's going to happen, and I don't think that's a particularly sound thing, because if people are working from home remotely and you get internet access cut off, then people lose their jobs and people can't go to college and people can't log on to their medical portal to get the prescription that they need to prevent themselves from having some sort of heart attack or something like that. You know, it's like the consequences of the cutoffs really, I think, resonated with even Justice Alito. Now, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, generally speaking, they're not very fond of technology companies, but both of them seemed somewhat more sympathetic to Cox's position than I would have necessarily expected.
It came out in the record pretty clearly that Sony, and it's not just Sony, it's a bunch of rights holders in Alliance, are engaged in a deliberate strategy. Cox is just kind of there in this lawsuit. I don't see them as good or bad, but I do have feelings, shall I say, about the way the rights holders are going about this. Justice Barrett at one point said, well, we're relying on Sony to be a good corporate citizen as well and not go after hospitals and universities. And there's really no evidence that they would be restrained in that regard. Paul Clement responds, well, it's not scalable for us to go after direct infringers. How much validity do you see in that claim?
I think it's absolutely true that it's just not cost effective to go against every single person who uses internet connection to use BitTorrent and get infringing songs or infringing movies. I think that's right. And the quote from one of Judge Posner's decisions in one of the peer-to-peer file sharing cases, you know, it's a teaspoon approach to an ocean problem. So I think the court actually would be sympathetic with that. On the other hand, if there were some subscribers of Cox that in fact didn't just get three notices, but got, you know, 400 a day, that's somebody you could go after, right? And Sony could go after some of the bigger infringers, or what were sometimes called the habitual infringers in the Sony case. So I think that actually they could go against some people. And so I don't know that the fact that they can't go against everybody is a reason for Cox to be held liable.
I should ask, any other observations about the oral argument? Anything that struck you that I have not done a good job of getting us into?
I think one of the things several justices were concerned about is that there isn't a contributory infringement provision in the 1976 Act. And the DMCA safe harbors is not a contributory infringement or a vicarious infringement standard. So, you know, one of the principles that you could take away from that. Now, there is some language that the authors have the exclusive right to do and, quote unquote, to authorize certain kinds of acts, such as reproductions of works and copies. So the two authorized language means that that if somebody authorized somebody else to infringe, that they can be held liable. If the only scope of contributory infringement in copyright law is to authorize, then totally Cox wins, right? Because Cox did not authorize any of its subscribers to engage in infringement. So a two authorized standard goes, would mean that they win. Now, the question is, you know, what do you make of it, right? There are three possibilities, right? One possibility is to say, well, it's not in the statute, and therefore there's no contributory infringement. Congress basically would have to revisit this and decide to enact a provision about contributory infringement. Two is, and this one came up also, is to rely on the patent statute, which does have contributory infringement, has two provisions, and the Supreme Court in the Sony Betamax and in the Grokster case both drew upon patent law principles in making decisions about secondary liability. And so the patent statute says that if you induce infringement, then that's a basis for liability. And there's no inducement claim here. There's no sort of affirmative act to support somebody else's infringement and also a specific intent to aid infringement. So under an inducement standard, basically Sony loses. The other contributory infringement standard that's in the patent statute is based on the principle that if a technology doesn't have a substantial non-infringing use, then you can hold somebody liable for contributory infringement of a patent. And if the court ends up borrowing that contributory infringement standard from the patent statute, again, Cox wins, because one of the things that the Solicitor General pointed out in its brief is that the service that Cox provides has substantial non-infringing uses. So under that standard, again, Cox would win. The third possibility is, again, this kind of general principle of tort. And some of the court's opinions in Sony and Grokster suggest that the court really thinks about contributory infringement and copyright law as consistent with general tort principles. And that's where the aiding and abetting statute or provisions of tort law have this kind of, you have to provide substantial assistance, and you have to do it in a way that intends to, you know, it's a purposeful effort to sort of make something happen. And if that's the standard, I think, again, Cox probably wins. So what Paul Clement was trying real hard to do is to say, hey, just stay within copyright law under the Gershwin standard, because the Gershwin standard says that if you contribute to, you materially contribute to someone else's infringement, and you know that you're doing that, that that's enough. And I think I think that's what the Fourth Circuit's Court of Appeals decided. That's what the case was argued on. And so I think that, again, the court is likely to say, we may have said something nice about the Gershwin decision and Grokster, but we're saying now that it doesn't satisfy common law standards. And I think there were some briefs that also made that kind of argument too.
That is such a great overview of the paths the court might take. What I struggle with is getting a sense from the argument of which one is going to appeal to them. Even Justice Gorsuch seemed to be at peace with the secondary liability being read into the statute, that ship has sailed. No one seemed, I read, to want to stick with the Fourth Circuit standard and say knowledge and inaction is enough. But as you have pointed out, several of the justices seemed uncomfortable with any standard that in effect leaves Cox able to do nothing, to just sit on its hands. So do you have any thoughts on what a workable solution might be here that doesn't necessarily give Cox everything it wants while not incredibly disrupting the internet?
I think one possibility, and I'm not going to predict that this is the way that the court's going to go. One possibility is for them to say that if Congress really wants to revisit the safe harbor provision and say what kind of repeat infringer of policy a conduit is supposed to have, that Congress can do that. So, you know, I think it's the case that the safe harbor provision doesn't exempt conduits from the requirement of having a repeat infringer policy. But there is no standard that's been set by the courts about what kind of repeat infringer policy do you have to have if you're a conduit. And that actually is not clear. Now, one of the things that is important to sort of understand is that Sony is treating every single one of the notices that was sent by this company that basically sends automatic notices of infringement. If it detects sort of some infringement happening, it just sends a notice that basically says, this is infringement. But there's no court determination that there has been any infringement. And it's pretty well known that some of the robot notices that get sent out are erroneous. And so there's no kind of due process built into this right now. So there's due process when you're talking about the other three categories within the safe harbor, right? The host, basically, the caching, and the information locating. You can actually, as the service provider, you can actually do something. It's not clear what sort of thing that the conduits are supposed to have to do. And so clarifying that is something that maybe Congress could do, or that maybe the somebody has to do something about. But the standard right now is just like, whatever, I think that Cox and others of the broadband providers, as well as others that are in the stack, including the electrical company, what are they supposed to do? I don't have control over those people.
Well, you have written eloquently about the importance for an online copyright regime to account for the interests of small and medium platforms and individual user creators. And I feel like you've segued us in well to that topic, because you're already getting us to what might a better or clearer regime look like. Maybe Sony somehow prevails here and Cox goes down in flames. It seems unlikely, but anything can happen. That creates all kinds of knock-on effects for potentially ways that network architectures have to change and all kinds of privacy problems. And on the ashes of that result, you are advising Congress to set up the system in the way that you would like it to look. What are you telling them?
That one of the primary benefits of the internet is its universal access. And it's so important to maintain universal access. And that's a value that I think members of Congress, even when they fight with each other about other things, we all use the internet now. And universal access means that people should be able to get on. So I think that if Congress wants to set up some sort of regime for the responsibility of conduits like Cox, that it should try to investigate, like, what are the possibilities here, and set up some sort of like standard that everybody can live with. Because if Sony does prevail in this particular case, there are going to be lots of internet subscribers who are going to lose access, and that's bad for everybody. Making conduits into copyright police. And one of the things that, again, I think you raised earlier, which I will repeat now, is that if just not cutting off when there's some sort of notice about some malfeasance by one of the subscribers' users is enough to basically cause institutions to lose internet access for any kind of wrongdoing, right? So it could be defamation, could be child pornography, could be privacy violations. They just can't be put in that kind of position. So I think that's important really to kind of say that copyright is important, but it's not the most important thing in our society. And so there's got to be a real balance. And Sony's efforts is not to get balance in copyright law. It's to basically force other entities to become its agents in enforcing copyright. And I don't think that's what the court wants, and I don't think that's what members of Congress will want.
So, Professor Samuelson, I could not possibly let you go without getting into artificial intelligence for a little bit. I'm so excited to pick your brain on some of this stuff. Let me try to segue us in a somewhat rational way from our previous discussion. There's all the AI copyright lawsuits and their ins and outs that we could have easily spent a whole hour talking about instead of what we talked about. But specifically, how will the spread of AI-generated content online potentially affect the copyright regime that we have been discussing today? Contributory liability, the spread of copyright infringement being easier potentially. Do you see there as any link between increased AI content and the issues at issue in Cox versus Sony?
I think most of the AI developers right now, especially the generative AI developers, are going to really look very carefully to whatever the Supreme Court has to say in this particular case, because there are contributory and vicarious infringement claims in several of the 65 lawsuits that are pending against the against developers now. And that's actually really important. So most of the claims and most of the attention have gone to direct infringement claims based on copying of copyright works in the course of training models. And that's a direct infringement claim, not an indirect infringement claim. And the first three decisions, basically, on that case, two of them say that it's fair use, and one of them says it isn't fair use, and the one that says it isn't fair use is actually up before an appellate court right now. And so we'll know something more about the direct infringement claims. But sometimes the outputs of these generative AI systems either are exact or substantially similar to some of the material that the model was trained on. And then the question is the user of the generative AI system that produces, for example, images, for example, of Superman, you know, going to the moon or something like that. Is that an infringement, right? If the generative AI company or the system basically produces what the user asked for, is the user an infringer? And if so, is there indirect infringement by these generative AI company? And so that's actually one of the issues that has come up and has been discussed, but there hasn't been really a ruling on it yet. So AI-generated content that isn't substantially similar to in copyright works that were used as training data, that stuff, according to the Copyright Office, is in the public domain. So there's a lot more public domain material now than there was before because there's no copyright according to the Copyright Office. So how is everybody supposed to be able to tell what's AI generated and therefore in the public domain and what's in copyright? That's going to create more confusion. And so, you know, I think that there are a whole kind of fistful of issues that will be raised in those cases. But directly, I think the generative AI companies are going to be waiting to see whether material contribution and knowing that somebody may infringe, which is the Fourth Circuit standard and what Sony is going for right now, if that standard holds, then that actually would have significant implications for the generative AI companies. If instead the court says, no, there has to be purposeful, culpable conduct on the part of a company before that company is held liable, I think the generative AI companies would sort of like, oh, shoo, we're okay. And so I think that's the most direct implication of the case for the generative AI developers.
You've forgotten more about this than I've ever known. So you'll have to tell me if I'm dropping into caricature, but it seems to me as I look at the history of technological advances, be it video cassettes or music streaming or now AI, the pattern tends to be that the Sonys of the world engage in the most uncreative response possible and rush into court and don't think about the possibilities for using the new thing in a way that redounds to their benefit. And eventually some equilibrium needs to be found where, for instance, Apple gets the music right holder to understand how good the new technology could be for them if they would just get on board and make some kind of arrangement. How do you think we get to that with AI? Do they just litigate it out until one side wins or the other loses or they reach a compromised position? Do they need to get in a room and engage in some negotiation? What needs to happen?
To be fair to Sony, Sony was actually the company that provided videotape recorders that subject of. So Sony has one set of interests when it's a technology provider and another set of interests when it's a copyright owner. And so I'm sure that there are some interesting conversations that take place in Sony headquarters because, you know, they got to have a consistent position. It's certainly the case that the lawsuits that have been brought against technology providers have, for the most part, been resulted in finding some sort of equilibrium. And one hopes that that will happen here. I think part of what's interesting about the AI space is that most of the lawsuits are actually not being brought by Disney and by, you know, there are now Disney cases, but until relatively recently, there weren't really, Universal Music went against a couple of the sort of the AI generated recorded music groups, but, you know, that's actually, those cases settled. And so I assume that actually they settled on terms that were mutually satisfactory. But, you know, except for the New York Times case against Microsoft and OpenAI, most of these lawsuits are brought by little guy authors. And, you know, that's actually pretty interesting that it wasn't Hachette or Macmillan that brought the lawsuits involving book authors or book, sort of the training on books. It was some of the individual authors. And so that the class action lawsuits, I think, are ones that there's just a lot of money at stake in those cases. And, you know, with respect to the class action cases, I don't see them settling because you just can't set up. I mean, the one case that's settled, the sort of the Anthropic case, settled for $1.5 billion. That's a lot of money. But that's actually just for supposedly past infringement, right? So the use of pirated books, they downloaded 7 million pirated books, and the BART's authors were able to persuade Anthropic to settle. But that's for past acts. It's not for training and not for any kind of output infringement. So we're kind of in a space where I think the litigation is going to go on for somewhere between 5 and 10 years, and then things will kind of shake out. I don't see one resolution here, but I think more of these cases will settle, especially with companies that are suing.
Well, Professor Samuelson, it has been a privilege and an honor. I appreciate your time so much.
Thanks so much. It's been fun talking to you. And I guess we'll see pretty soon how things shake out. I don't think the court's going to wait until the last day of its year, right? So usually the court issues its last opinions in the last week of June or the very first week of July. And I don't see this one waiting that long. I'm guessing that they'll get something out in kind of March or April.
As long as they don't dismiss it as improvidently granted between the end of this recording and us getting it up online, I will be happy.
Yes. Okay, good.
This has been the Tech Policy Podcast. I am Corbin Barthold. I've been joined by the one and only Pamela Samuelson. If you enjoy conversations like this one, please go give the show a 5-star rating wherever you listen. Subscribe, tell your friends, do all the good things. And while you go do that, I will get started on the next one. Thank you all. Till next time.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.